Okay, the recording is on. Let's get this other one set up. Now this recording is also on, and hopefully between the two of these recordings, we'll get a valid recording. Okay, welcome everybody back. Moed Tov. Hope you're enjoying your Chol HaMoed. Welcome to another installment in our series, Tefillah, the Past, the Practical, and the Profound, where we discuss the halachot, the history, and the meaning of the prayers. And so continuing the theme of Pesach that we started before Yom Tov, last time we met, we spoke about Moshe's prayer at the sea, which truthfully would have been a fitting topic for now, because as we know, our tradition teaches that the seventh day of Pesach was the seventh day of Pesach is the celebration of the splitting of the sea. So that could have been relevant now also, but I actually want to share another Pesach message, and this is a message that I think is very profound, has a lot to teach us about our own role and responsibility in prayer, also can teach us some halachot about prayer. And I think we can come away from it more informed, not just about the laws involved in Jewish prayer and tefillah, but also understand, I think, something more fundamental that undergirds the entire endeavor of tefillah to begin with. Okay, sound good? Great. So let's, and this will probably be a bit of a shorter class today, but let's start off with source number one. We spoke really at length in our first several sessions about the history of tefillah. And not all of them made it into the recording because the recordings had this glitch, as we spoke about. But we spoke about the history of tefillah. And we read sources that tefillah is established, or was established, at least in some respects. It's modeled after the korbanot. It was modeled after the sacrifices that were offered in temple times and will be offered again, presumably. So this idea that tefillah is keneged the korbanot, is established and modeled after these korbanot that we used to offer, actually has bearing on halacha. It's not just to teach us philosophically what tefillah comes to do and what gap, what lacuna it comes to fill. Here, I have a source sheet if you want. And tefillah, we're talking about, you didn't miss much, we're talking here about tefillah, and we're talking about how it was modeled after the korbanot. But that idea that tefillah was modeled after the korbanot also teaches us halachot of tefillah. Certain halachot that, because tefillah is modeled after the korbanot, certain halachot that apply to the korbanot are also going to apply to tefillah. So for example, if you look in source number one, the Shulchan Aruch lists, HaTefillah hi bimkom hakorban. The tefillah, the prayer, is in place of the sacrifice. And therefore, somebody must be careful that their tefillah resembles the sacrifice, bekavana, in intent. What does that mean, that your tefillah should resemble the sacrifice in intent? So the Shulchan Aruch continues in the top of the first line of the first source. V'lo yarev ba machashava acheret. One should not mix it with any other extraneous thoughts. Just as one must have purity of intent when offering korbanos, I'm not going to go into all that now, what that means, but when it comes to tefillah, one must also have a certain level of purity of intent. In other words, one should be careful not to think other things during tefillah, save for the things that they are saying and the things that they are speaking about. What's another example? Umad. Tefillah, yes, timing is true. We're not going to talk about that now. Umad. Tefillah must be performed while standing. Why does tefillah have to be performed while standing? Well, the Shulchan Aruch says, Dumya de Avoda, because the priests who offered the sacrifices stood. They had to stand when they offered the sacrifices. And so too, if the tefillah is a sacrifice, then those who offer the tefillah are like the priests who offered the sacrifice, and we need to stand when we daven our tefillah. And this, by the way, is all referring to Shemona Esrei specifically. Okay. So we have that you're not supposed to think other things like a korban, like when the korbanot were being offered. You're supposed to stand. What else? Kviut makom. One should establish a fixed place for themselves. Just as the korbanot all had a fixed place, and just as if all these different korbanot, and if you read the sections on the korbanot, you'll know that this one is slaughtered here, and its blood is court over here. So just as all the korbanot have a fixed place where their avoda, where the offering process takes place, so too our tefillot should be in a fixed place. In the synagogue, one should establish themselves a specific seat. That's their seat. And daven in that place when they can.
Oh, wow, it's halacha.
When they can. When they can. Yeah. V'shelo yachutz yichutz davar beino lekir. One, and there should not be any separation between oneself and the wall. Now, the Mishnah Berurah, in talking about this halacha, says obviously it's not possible. If everybody followed this halacha, then definitionally, there's only so many spots right in front of the wall. There have to be two rows of people, and the people who are in the second row are not in the first row. They're not facing the wall. It's really, so it's not essential. And also, the tefillah is going to be valid if you're not fixed, if you don't daven in a set place. It's also going to be valid if you don't daven right next to the wall. But it's an ideal. Okay.
Well, the chair is fixed to the floor, which is connected.
So the poskim do talk about that. What counts as an interposition? What if it's connected to the floor? What, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to get into that now. Maybe we'll have a whole shiur on it.
And what
does
that have? Would you daven right in front of the wall?
So he says, she says, davar beino lakir. You should not have an interposition between you and the wall. So that, but so it's so. And the poskim talk about, are people considered an interposition? Well, the truth is, most people are not makpid for this, and in some ways, it's a good thing, because otherwise, you'd have everybody fighting for primary real estate. I wouldn't say it's something to worry about so much. Okay. Just as the Kohanim were not allowed to have any interposition between themselves and the vessels they were using as part of their service, so too there should not be any interposition between yourself and, I guess, the vessel that's holding you, the synagogue, as you perform your service, as you offer your tefillah. Okay. But
Did they take off the shoes?
The priests? The Kohanim were not wearing shoes when they did the service. Okay.
I mean, my immediate thought would be, if you were in Yisrael and you were going to see a korban, you weren't. You were just in this big area, right? You didn't have a fixed seat in the temple. The Kohanim had a fixed thing. So if you're a Kohen, maybe this would apply to you more.
Well, we're talking about, because the tefillah is the korban, we're, all of us who offer the tefillah are all proverbially korbanot when we are all proverbially priests. Excuse me, when we pray. Okay. Interesting.
Is there any halacha about how loud? When you're davening?
There are actually halacha to talk
some
about that.
Some people feel they should be loud, and other people feel it's a distraction.
And the Sephardim chant out loud.
Sure. So when it comes to Shemona Esrei, Shemona Esrei is called the silent prayer because it's supposed to be recited silently. You're not supposed to. One is not supposed to daven loud enough that the person next to them will hear them. It's really inappropriate to do so because you're disturbing other people who are praying. That may not apply on Rosh Hashanah, which is an interesting halacha. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that another time, but that's the basic halacha. Okay. But I really...
Tongue in cheek, what happens to a traveling consultant or salesman who's in a different shul every day?
What do you mean what happens to them? They should daven in their shul?
No, but he's got, you're going to be in Monday, you're going to be in Yom.
You're saying because of a fixed place?
Yes.
Yeah, so when you're in your synagogue, you daven in a fixed place, and when you're not, you're not. This is an ideal, but it's not something that should prevent you from traveling, should you need to travel or want to travel. And it's not something that will be prevent the tefillah from being considered a valid tefillah. But what I want to draw out from this is that the Shulchan Aruch said umar, that it should be recited while standing. Domya de avoda, just as the avoda was performed while standing. Now, when the Shulchan Aruch says that it's important to daven while standing, you can ask a question. I think it's actually a more important question for our purposes than seems on the surface. I actually want to emphasize, I want to argue that I think this question can teach us something, or at least the answer to this question can teach us something important, not just about the halachot of tefillah, but about what it means to have a relationship with God. Question is, what about leaning? What if you're not sitting, but you're leaning on something? Let's say I'm standing up, I'm davening, and I'm bearing, I'm pushing weight on something else. Is that considered to be standing according to halacha? Or is it not considered to be standing? Of course, we're going to answer that question. But is that considered to be standing according to halacha? Or is that considered to be not standing? On the one hand, your legs, when you're leaning on something, are more or less straight. On the other hand, you're not bearing your own weight. You're actually kind of, something else is supporting you. So maybe you can say that standing definitionally is supporting yourself. When you're not supporting yourself, you're leaning. Is that considered standing or is that considered sitting? So the truth is, because this is all modeled after the korbanot, we have only to look at the Gemaras that talk about the Korbanot that discuss this very question. When it comes to a priest offering the temple sacrifices, when the priest is leaning, is that considered standing or is that considered sitting? So the Gemara addresses this question. Source number two, Tanur Rabbanan, our sages taught, Ketzad Mitzvah Kiddush. When it comes to the mitzvah of sanctifying the Kohen's hands and feet, the Kohen has to wash his hands and feet before performing the temple service. So when that occurs, how does that happen? So the Gemara continues, Maniach Yado Hayamanit Al Gabe Raglo Hayamanit. What the Kohen does is he puts his right hand over his right hand over his left foot. V'yado Hasmolit Yado Hayamanit means his right hand. Yado Hayamanit Al Gabe Raglo Hayamanit. His right hand over his right foot. V'yado Hasmolit Al Gabe Raglo Hasmolit. And he puts his left foot on below his left hand. In other words, right hand on top of right foot, left hand on top of left foot. Umekadesh, and he does the washing that way. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Omer, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda.
Someone else is pouring the water?
Wait a minute. So Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says, he says as follows, Meniach shtei yadav zo al gav zo ve al gave shtei raglav. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi says, he says he puts both his hands on top of the other and lays them together on top of both of his feet, themselves laid on top of the other, and he does it that way. The Leviim are the ones who wash the Kohanim's hands in the temple. Okay, good question. So,
can he stay balanced?
Ah, so yeah. Great question. So what did they say to him? Amrulo, they said, if he's putting both of his hands on top of the other, and he puts them on top of both feet, and he does it to them, they said to him, Haflagata efshar la'asot kein. What are you talking about here? It's impossible to work like that. You're going to fall over. You're not going to be able to balance that way. Ah.
Yeah, I can do it. No.
So, Shapir ka'amre le'amar of Yosef chaveiro mesayo. When the Kohen did this, his friends would help him stay balanced, and they would hold him aloft so that he can do this. That's the answer to the question. Okay. But what emerges from this is that Rabbi Yosef and the sages disagree with Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda. The sages say, one hand on one foot, one hand on the other foot. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says, no, both hands and on top of both feet, and people balance them. Yeah. So the Gemara asks a question.
That's not standing.
The Gemara is asking a question, which is Ma Beinayhu. We know there's this machlokas between the sages and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda about how the Kohen should do the Avodah. What is the difference between their reasoning such that they end up at disparate positions? It's a good logical question, meaning what do they disagree about that led them to think that this one was the right answer and led Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda to think that this way was the right answer? So the Gemara says, Amar Abaye, Abaye answered this question, Amida min hatzad ika. The difference between them is their opinion regarding standing with min hatzad, with support from the side, i.e. leaning. According to the sages, this is not going to be considered standing, and the priest cannot sanctify his hands and feet while in such a position because the priest has to be standing. And
I say you're not standing.
And the sages, if Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says that you need someone to hold you up, you're effectively leaning on them. And therefore, they're not going to hold. That's a valid way to do the avodah. So it must be that you have to do the avodah the way that they specified. So we can learn from the sages that, at least according to the sages, that leaning when it comes to performing the temple service is not going to be considered standing. In other words, the sages say that you have to wash your hands a certain way. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says, no, you wash them another way, and to help you stay on balance, you have people support you. So we know from the sages' fact that they don't agree with that logic, that they must hold, Abaye says, that is not considered standing. But Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda does consider that to be standing, and so he thinks that that is a valid way to wash one's hands, and that's the thing one should do. What emerges from this, though, is that it's a machlokas. It's a machlokas. It's a machlokas between...
We can't have standards.
What do you mean?
Have standards. Are we allowed to have shtenders and lean on shtenders?
Well, you're certainly allowed to have shtenders, but when it comes to leaning on a shtender, so then according to the sages who say that leaning is not considered standing, one should not lean on it. You could always use it in front of you to help you daven. Right. But according to the sages, one should not lean on something because leaning is not considered standing. And the truth is...
I would think that why would they have a difference in how it was done? And why we could do it that way is just to save water, because there wasn't a lot of water. So if you put your hands and feet all together at one time, you save water than if you do it separately. So I might make an argument that if you need to save water, it would be considered standing. But if you don't need to save water, then you should do it the other way. So in other words, it's not standing, but so in other words, like if your knee, like my knee hurts, and I have to dive in and I have to hold on to something and I'm standing, that's okay. But if I can do it with standing, that's sort of thinking that way.
Okay, interesting. So we have this machlokas in the Gemara. So how do we paskin? Is leaning considered standing? Is it not considered standing? And again, because the whole reason we stand is because of the Kohanim are supposed to stand. And however we paskin, however we rule in this machloket between what the Kohanim did should be what we do. So sure enough, the Shulchan Aruch rules in source number 3, Yesh li zacher shelo lismoch asmo la'amod o lechavero b'sha'as tefila. One should be careful not to support oneself by leaning on a pillar or by leaning on their friend during a time of prayer. So the Shulchan Aruch rules in accordance with the position of the sages that is not going many Rishonim do too. That is not going to be considered leaning, and so therefore one during Shema B'nei Shemona Esrei may not lean on something during the time of prayer. Yeah.
For us, we wash our hands before we pray. The prayer is what we're doing with the tefillah. Why is the washing of the hands considered their tefillah?
The washing of the hands is considered an essential part of the temple service.
Right.
So...
But isn't the korban note the service?
The korban is the subject of the service. Mm. That's what we offer, but that is not the object. The object is how we conduct ourselves while saying the tefillah. And so just as the Kohanim stood when they did that, so we should stand when we do our service.
I still say they're not standing because they've bent over.
Well, they're leaning on something. So he says leaning is going to be a problem. And the truth is that we paskin, the Mishnah Berurah paskins at the end of the day, that leaning, because it's not considered standing to lean on something, that only applies when if you were to remove that item, you would fall. You wouldn't be able to support yourself. Meaning everybody's touching something sometimes when they daven, they have a shtender in front of them. So touching it is not going to be a problem. But leaning on something enough that it's holding your weight such that if the item were to be removed, you wouldn't be able to support yourself normally anymore. So that would be considered, that would be the threshold for what's considered leaning here. Okay. Now, the Magen Avraham, Rabbi Avraham Gombiner, who wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Or HaChaim section of Shulchan Aruch, which is what we're talking about now, writes that this halacha, not to lean, he actually has two reasons for it. We assume that the reason is, what's the reason?
That you're not standing.
We assume the reason is because it's modeled after the avoda that was done in the Beis HaMikdash, and so just as the avoda was performed standing, so too the tefillah has to be performed standing. So that's the first answer he gives. Tam perish harav habet Yosef delo chashiv amida kishesomich atzma. It's not considered standing when one leans oneself, and one has to stand, and so that is why one is not permitted to lean. He does quote another reason. Vahagos maimonios, another rishon mefarish hatam ditzarich laamod be'ema. That another reason why you're not allowed to lean is because leaning demonstrates casualness. And it's not proper when approaching God to lean on something. It's a little bit too haphazard looking. It's not respectful towards God. When one is standing in prayer, they should be standing in awe. And so they should be standing erect. They should be standing straight. So he gives two reasons for this. Number one, what we've been discussing. You have to stand during the tefillah, and this leaning is not considered standing. And number two, this leaning, not very respectful when someone is praying towards God. Now look, if somebody is sick and they can't help it, then it's not disrespectful at all. And in fact, that's what someone should do if they can't stand. They should lean on something. Absolutely they should. And that is totally fine for somebody who needs to do so. But it is important to be able to pray to God, one who is able to, with the posture that that reflects the seriousness of the interaction. Okay. So what does this have to do with Pesach? What does this have to do with Pesach? We're in Chol HaMoed right now. That's true. We're supposed to lean. That's an interesting connection, but that's not what I want to take it today. You were saying something?
Okay.
Leaning during the Seder. So that's a good connection. That's probably a redhead misleading on my part. Because when we're talking about leaning, what's the first thing you think of on Pesach is leaning at the Seder. So the truth is that there's actually a pasuk in Shmos during the Exodus story in source number 5. The Torah teaches us, V'et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha asher ta'aseh bo et ha-otot. God tells Moshe, when he sends Moshe to perform all the plagues, God tells Moshe, V'et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha asher ta'aseh bo et ha-otot. This rod, this staff, I'm giving you a staff, take the staff in your hand and perform the signs. That's what I want you to do. And we know Moshe's staff is famous. Comes up in multiple psukim. God tells Moshe to take his staff. And the truth is, at the Seder, this is one of the things that we say. We recite this passage. Ve'et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha. God tells Moshe to take his staff. That's part of what we say during Magid. And it read a certain Rabbi Norman Lamb, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, who was the previous president of Yeshiva University, passed away just a couple of years ago, in his Haggadah to make the following remark. If you turn your sheet horizontally, on page number 2, the source on the left. V'et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha. After Moses is persuaded by the Almighty to undertake the historic mission of leading the children of Israel out of Egypt, he is commanded, V'et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha. And you shall take in your hand this rod to perform the miracles. What happens? Moses then proceeds to take leave of his father-in-law and Midian for the perilous and fateful journey to Egypt. This is all before Moshe goes back to Egypt to set the plagues in motion. In obedience to the divine command, we do read that Moshe took this matzah in his hand. And this, by the way, anybody who's listening remotely, is from Rabbi Norman Lamb's Haggadah titled The Royal Table, pages 58 and 59 in the footnotes. Moshe takes his staff in his hand, and God tells Moshe, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Paro all the miracles which I have put in your hand. Okay, so the staff is a central part of the Exodus story. And actually, in my Seder, we discussed, why did Moshe need a staff in the first place? Why couldn't Moshe just use his hands? Why couldn't God have given the power to Moshe's hands to do it? Why did he need Moshe to use a staff? So I think that maybe the answer is that power, and especially miracle-working power, is a very dangerous thing. When somebody can do things with their body, when they can effect miracles with their body, people are liable to deify them. It's very easy to be persuaded by somebody who's a miracle worker, and Moshe is clearly a miracle worker. Maybe God tells Moshe to take the staff to dilute some of that power. It's not just Moshe himself, but it's only Moshe in combination with another object, something that's outside of himself that can accomplish this. And that can, I think, help people have a healthier relationship with Moshe as a person instead of a God. Because again, we risk deifying people who are all powerful, very powerful. Okay. But Rabbi Norman Lamb writes something else. And he says that which we just read. In the laws of prayer, the Shulchan Aruch teaches that during the recitation of the Amidah, the Shemona Esrei, it is improper to lean upon the table or stand on one's neighbor. We just read that, remember? You're not supposed to lean on a pillar. You're not supposed to lean on another person next to you. And he makes the following philosophical point. This is not just a halacha. Yes, it is a halacha, but it is not just a halacha. It does not just mean the Shulchan Aruch, the halacha, that one is not allowed to lean, does not just mean physically you should make sure that you're not putting pressure on any other surface during your tefillah. It also means, it conveys an ethic. What's the ethic? In our relations with God, we must approach Him directly. He continues on the next page, we must stand on our own 2 feet and take our spiritual destinies into our own hands. We must not rely upon the cantor or the rabbi or anyone else to pray on our behalf. Before God, it is every person for himself or herself. To seek out a rabbi as a or a scholar as a teacher of Torah is to use a rod of God, is to use the staff. But to look at him as someone to lean upon and thus avoid our own intimate personal religious responsibilities as a vicarious observer of our religious obligations, that is using man as a crutch. In other words, where we see the imperative to lean or to refrain from leaning more accurately during tefillah, Rabbi Norman Lam sees a philosophical point that just as it's important not to lean on something physical, it is important not to lean on anybody else to affect our prayers. We must, he continues, rely upon God and not his rod, upon the Creator, not his creatures. Part of our problem, he says, is that we are always looking for a mate Elohim, a staff of God, when the secret to our success or failure lies biyadecha, in our hands. We spend our time in search of magic wands, when there is magic in our hands, if they be but wedded to full hearts and open minds and clear eyes. Where we see a commandment not to lean, Rabbi Lam sees the ethic that one should really make sure not to rely on other people to do our prayers for us. Sometimes I think people show up to shul and they expect the rabbi and the chazan to conduct the service. That's really unfortunate. In every synagogue service, there are 50 or 100 or 150, however many people are there, service is actually happening. The chazan might be there to keep pace. The rabbi might be there to speak, maintain decorum, maybe help the community out with the halachot. But it is upon each and every individual to do the prayers themselves. I think that Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, of course, is a controversial figure in Orthodoxy. We don't agree with everything that he says. But he writes, I think, very aptly in his book, Man's Quest for God, on page number 50. It's actually a whole chapter titled "Pre-Refer." He talks about a problem that he thinks is called praying by proxy. That's what he terms it, praying by proxy. And I think that's what Rabbi Lam is talking about here also, praying by proxy. He writes, people expect the rabbi to conduct a service, an efficient, expert service. But efficiency and rapidity are no remedy against devotional sterility. We have developed the habit, he says lamentingly, we have developed the habit of praying by proxy. Many congregants seem to have adopted the principle of a vicarious prayer. The rabbi or the cantor does the praying for the congregation. Men and women would not raise their voices unless the rabbi issues the signal. Alas, they have come to regard the rabbi as a master of ceremonies.
Have you seen an Orthodox synagogue where they do that?
Where they do what?
This.
What? What's this?
Praying by proxy.
I mean, it's an attitude. It's an attitude. It's an attitude.
No, but like nobody will raise their voices unless the rabbi is.
Yeah, there. Well, there are branches within Judaism where they're not participatory. They're like.
I think absolutely there are people who daven in Orthodox shuls who absolutely behave this way, who absolutely will feel that by coming to shul they are absolving themselves of the responsibility to do their own part in the tefillah service. I think that many people come to shul and they don't even pray. Maybe you're very holy, so that seems far fetched to you, but I think it's the truth.
Synagogues where they have a choir. Beautiful, right?
Remember, Heschel, who was my teacher, was mainly teaching conservatives, rabbis, and conservatives.
Right. There was an article that came out recently about how this is a problem in conservative congregations. This whole idea of pray, they didn't use that term, I don't think, but the idea of praying by proxy.
They used chant.
Chant, whatever, yeah, whatever it is. So. But I think that when people come to synagogue, I think sometimes they're liable to feel that because there are so many people praying and the prayer service is happening, that they're absolved of their own need. Or even that there's a shul where prayer is taking place and they don't come to shul. The shul is taking care of the prayer. And I think that's what Rabbi Lam and what Rabbi Heschel are talking about here. That, he writes, we must rely upon God, not his rod, upon the Creator, not his creatures. It's not about what other people are doing. Maybe they're doing the service. Maybe they're getting things done. But it's on all of us to make sure that we have our own relationships with God. It's on all of us to make sure that we take our prayer and our responsibility to pray seriously. And I think that we learn all of this from something important in the Pesach story. It's actually the very moment when Moshe goes back to the Jewish people, that right before then, really, that God tells him to take his staff. And that, again, Rabbi Lamb sees this idea. So again, I hope you learned something about either the halachot of prayer, or at least philosophically, about what the proper orientation towards prayer should be, and that orientation namely being that it's important to take ownership of one's own prayers. And if not, then at least you learned something about the temple service. Okay.
I'm curious. Moshe's rod, is it like a shepherd's crook?
Hold on one second.